If you believe it's working, it's working, right?
Believe.
I believe it's working.
Hey, there we go. So, everybody, we have Crit Killen.
Hello, everyone.
Hi. We're going to try to make this less awkward, but yeah.
Okay.
So, do you want to explain to listeners and to our wonderful guests what you do?
Well, currently, I'm actually a script doctor, so I'm working on scripts and people's screenplays from the studios and stuff. So I'm also teaching at Utah Valley University, doing a screenwriting class there. I originally started in the film business, though, doing special effects, props, miniatures, all those kind of things, way before the computer was invented. So when everything had to be built, everything had to be made, everything had to be created from something tangible, then that was my start.
Nice.
So, yeah, it was a bit like, I kind of look at it now like the cowboy era, where, it's like, everyone thinks a cowboy, at least I do, the cowboy era lasted a long time. You know, you think of the Old West, but really it was only about 15 years that the real cowboy, as we think of a cowboy, if that's even real, but think of a cowboy, existed, right? And so the film industry, it had its heyday with, you know, Dawn of the Dead and Halloween and all those kinds of movies and all the, well, even The Abyss and things, where everything was made practically. Everything that was shown on screen had to be created. And so I got in, fortunately, right in the heyday of all that kind of stuff that needed to be built. And so it was just this incredible era that just came and went like a cowboy. So it'd be like a cowboy riding his horse into town, gets off, steps down off his horse, and a car drives by. Just two separate worlds kind of colliding. And so I can remember working, and we're building this prop. I was actually doing a Dodge commercial for the car company. And a guy came in, while we had made everything practically, a guy came in with this strange-looking contraption. It didn't have a monitor, but it had what we now know as a motherboard. And he was able to control these motors and everything from this, what we now would call a computer. And it was like, wow, here we are sort of standing there with paint and dirt on our hands and all messy. And then here's this incredible piece of technology that just did everything we did, but did it perfectly. And it was repeatable exactly the same way each and every time, where each time we did something, there was a little bit of a variation in it. You know, we might throw this too hard and they'd have to do another take or something. So really, that was my start, was back in an era that no longer exists, that just was a small little time frame, I don't know, 10, 12 years or something. And it came and went like the cowboy era did. And it was just, I look back and go, wow, that was really cool, but I didn't realize that it would be so impactful, you know, now. I mean, people look back on it, you know, as fondly as the good old days and everything. So back in the days when I had hair.
So what time frame was that approximately?
Like 1980, 81 is when I went in, and I started with doing designs for Blade Runner, the original Blade Runner.
Nice.
And so 80s. I mean, it had been going for a little while before I got there, obviously. But it was, I think, what, like maybe mid-70s or something, and then it went up to like maybe into the 90s. So, you know, 15-ish years.
So you didn't have to deal with the Ben-Hur. You know, claymies.
Yeah, I didn't have to do the Ben Hur. Although I did work with Ray Harryhausen, who had started, I mean, he was like the master of the stop motion puppets. He did Jason and the Argonauts, where they had all the, they animated the skeletons. I don't know if you've seen that or not. So, yeah, so I worked with Ray Harryhausen. You can Google that name. And he did Jason and the Argonauts. He did Valley of the Guanji with the T-Rex. And I think that had Raquel Welch in it too, I think. But did Raquel Welch? Yeah, and so Valley of the Guanji with a dinosaur. So anyway, I met him through a professor of mine, and we did some things. And I think he passed away a couple years ago now. But so I actually did kind of touch that era. You know, I sort of touched. I mean, I'm going to be 60 years old in like 4 months. So I'm pretty old, right? So I did touch that era. I mean, those guys were old, but it was some of those original guys. You know, the Frank Capra. I don't know if you know that name, but they did It's a Wonderful Life, you know, all those original kind of that heyday movie time. They were at the end of their careers and stuff, and their lives, unfortunately. And I was just beginning, but it was amazing how we just sort of melted from one into the other. And so I was able to glean a lot of good things from those original guys that's lost. I mean, even the stuff that we pioneered is lost now. different ways to do things that they just don't do them anymore because they don't need to. But so yeah, so around 1981 is when I 81 is when I went in. So
okay. That's pretty awesome. So like, what other things have you actually worked on that you're famous for or just like known for? Or
well, Predator was a big one. Beetlejuice probably the biggest one. And if you go to my table in the back, I have the Beetlejuice. I have the business card Michael Keaton gave me from Beetlejuice. Worked a lot with him. So I know you can't see it, but I actually have it. Because I always leave it. I always set it down, and my son's like, Dad, you're going to lose that one of these days. But so that's the Beetlejuice card from the movie. And then one of the costumes, you know, they have, it's back at the table. But so Beetlejuice was a huge one, and I'd actually turned it down 3 times because it just seems so ridiculous. I mean, when you read about it, and it's like, who's this guy Tim Burton? I think he'd done Frankenweenie maybe, and
I don't think he'd done that. That was one of his early.
Yeah, I can't, but he wasn't anyone. Michael Keaton wasn't even actually cast in the movie when we started it, so we didn't know like, oh, this guy's going to be in, or this director is this, or whatever. You can't hear, yeah. So. But yeah, so they didn't even know who we didn't know. I mean, know who was going to actually be cast. So it was exciting to kind of get on to that thing once I finally accepted it. And I only accepted it because a lot of my friends were working on it, and they said, "Oh, you got to come over, man." I mean, you know, all my like Captain Pete was there. This guy Captain Pete Gerard and Dave Beasley and all these different guys that were, you know, famous in the movie industry for special effects, they were all working on it, so it was like, all right, well, the movie looks stupid, but I can hang out with all my friends and we can have fun making it. So I went, and I didn't realize it was going to be what we now know as Beetlejuice. It was just kind of a, because I was working on RoboJocks, I think, at the time, which obviously never gained any fame because you don't know what that movie is, and it was just, you know, kind of terrible, but kind of cultishly, it's kind of cool if you watch it, and it gets those bad movie cult followings, you know.
Oh yeah.
And so it was like strange that I would want to continue working on, you know, some of these movies that you thought were going to be good, and I turned down the one that actually turned out to be good. So anyway, I ended up going over there, and it was a lot of fun, and then there was just so much stuff. I mean, there was never an end to the stuff from the, you know, the shrimp fingers and the flat man and, oh, it was just a world of wonderful stuff.
So, like, last year, you did actually tell the story about Beetlejuice, and I remember just kind of when you actually explained it, there was another special effect in the movie that you turned down as well, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. This famous, I'm famous for great decisions, and so what happened was is that, so you remember, was it in Hell that they were in the waiting room at Hell to be sentenced or judged or whatever it was? And there was the lady that got her throat, she died by having her throat slit, but she was smoking. And so when she would smoke, the smoke would come out the slit, if you remember Beetlejuice, right? So she'd take a drag on the cigarette, and when she wouldn't blow it out her mouth, it'd just come out that slit where she had been her cut. Well, so I was working on something, and someone said, hey, you got to go over to the set and... you know, you got to blow the smoke through the tube to come out, you know, that slit when she talks. And I'm like, I'm just too busy. I don't want to go over there. I've got too much to do. Some, you know, Dave, you go do it. You know, so, you know, he didn't want to go do it either, but he goes and does it because I wasn't going to do it. Well, it turns out that because she's a speaking actress, she's in SAG, right, the Screen Actors Guild. And so she's paid a royalty and a residual from the movie. Well, it turns out that because he assisted her and worked in that, then he's part of that. He's part of her package or whatever in that. And so he got paid residuals. And so it's like in the first two months of Beetlejuice showing, this guy had gotten like $50,000 in residuals or some ridiculous number, and didn't really need to work in the film industry anymore. And so I'm thinking, oh my gosh, if I'd have just gone blown smoke. Up or out, I guess. Yeah, right? Yeah. If I'd just gone and blown some smoke, I would have gotten, yeah, that would have been me getting all that money. And he got it for years, because Beetlejuice was so popular and played so much that, yeah, it really worked out well. And I was thinking, man, you know, decisions we make, it just seems so innocent. Like, nah, I don't want to go do it. I've got too much to do. I got to finish this. And not knowing that, yeah, that, yeah.
All the responsibilities to add more responsibilities.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. So, anyway, I like to think about that when I'm presented with things and go, well, let's see, how could that work out in the end? Maybe I better, I don't want to do it, but maybe I better, so, yeah, interesting.
Is there any other projects that you worked on that you generally have maybe additional regrets not actually like being a part of, or just?
Well, I mean, there's a lot. I mean, I did work on the Phantom Menace and stuff, and you know, you get so busy that you don't necessarily think in terms. Well, we didn't back then so much because you didn't keep props. I'm surprised I have this Beetlejuice card because, I mean, I don't know how I've held on to a little piece of paper for all these years, right? And you didn't have, it wasn't until Planet Hollywood came along, I think, that you didn't really think about props in the way we think about them today, or collector's items or things like that. So when we did Nightmare on Elm Street 3, I think, Dream Warriors, I did the Big Freddy snake. I did the molding and stuff for that, and we poured it and made all the stuff with it, and someone else painted it. But anyway, so we took it and we were on set with it and operating it and doing all that stuff. And then when it's the Big Freddy snake, if you've seen Nightmare on Elm Street 3, and he eats Patricia Arquette, swallows her or whatever, or tries to eat her. So that snake is huge. I mean, it can swallow a human whole, right? It was ginormous, and it's Freddy's head, and it's really cool. And so when we were done shooting, like, they're just going to throw it out. So we're like, yeah, we'll take it home, you know, just because it would be fun to hang up in the shop. Well, it blew out of the back of our pickup truck on the way home on the freeway, and it just got completely obliterated because it's just soft foam, right? So we lost that. But I'm saying, why would they even have let that go? I mean, nowadays, I mean, it would be just incredible to have, and they'd hang it up or they'd show it at the premiere or something, right? But back then, they didn't do it. So to answer your question, it's like, we didn't think so much in terms of, wow, this is going to bring me a lot of fame, or this is going to be really cool, because there was no IMDb, so you didn't really worry about, you didn't even think about that. It's like, everyone knew who you were, and if they didn't, then didn't matter too much. And so, yeah, it just was a different world. So I didn't push Phantom Menace. I didn't push the Star Wars series very much. I did a number of Star Trek ones, but I didn't push that as much. And then when I came out and found out that I was a Trekkie, you know, it's like, oh my gosh, I could have done so many more, you know, movies and things. But you think back on it, it was just more or less like a convenience, or maybe that studio was too far away and you didn't want to drive in LA traffic. When today it'd be like, yeah, I'll go work there for, you know, I'll do whatever I have to get to there. So yeah, kind of sad that we didn't have the insight that we have now, you know. So
you have something?
No, I don't have anything.
You look like you had a thought.
No.
No, he has no thought.
I have no thoughts. Only thoughts I have is hindsight's 2020, basically.
Yeah, hindsight's 2020, yeah. And just the way it's all grown up. I mean, that's why we're here today, is because an entire mindset has changed. And, well, we have Negan sitting down here in the audience, and he's, you know, I mean, he looks just like him. And we're celebrating that because, yeah, I don't know how it turned like that. I don't know, why didn't we do that before? He is, he's saying he's older than me. I don't know about that. He's looking pretty good. But but yeah, so it's really exciting that we are keeping all, we keep the things, and we reproduce the things that keeps it alive. And, you know, and by doing that, we also, everyone gets trained in how to make things so that they can make more things. You know, I mean, back then, you know, you had a handful of guys in the special effects industry. There was people like Screaming Mad George. So anybody listening to this, and Screaming Mad George, and, you know, I mean, just so many people. But yet it was a small community, and they traveled around from studio to studio doing, for the most part, doing most of the movie work. Rick Lazzarini, I mean, he was, you know, did all, like, made the alien, that little alien when it popped out, he's the one who made it run across the floor and different things. And they were just guys who were specialized in it. And so everyone else wondered, how in the world do you do that? Where today, I mean, I can see people that I know in the audience right now who know how to do their own stuff. I mean, it was just in a panel talking about steampunk guns. And now so many people know how to do it, and it's a bigger world that now we have even more things that are just amazing, because it's not a small group, it's a big collective group that makes stuff.
It is amazing how everybody is embracing all of this change and actually like keeps this kind of thing going as far as the Phantom Cons or just all the projects that are happening.
Right.
Actually, last year, it was kind of an amazing Phantom Con, and I enjoyed it a lot. And the first time I met you, my husband and I, we were kind of sitting in the back, and we were doing the dinner meet and greet with all of our guests that came. And so when it came time to actually kind of sit down with food and eat, you and Katrine and Russ Adams and just a bunch of you guys, Worky, you guys all kind of came and you guys kind of were nice, really nice. And you guys were like, can we sit with you? And we were like, yeah. And so you guys sat down and it was amazing because like you guys talked about so many different stories about how you got into the business and everything. Mm-hmm. And even afterwards, like we were able to kind of hang out with you. And so
yeah, that was fun, wasn't it?
It was a lot of fun. So we did the haunted tour with you and everything.
Right.
So after that, my husband and I did hang out with you a little bit longer, but you were kind of telling your story about how you got into Hollywood or just kind of into the business itself.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And I was kind of wondering if you might be able to kind of share some of that with us.
Sure. Yeah, I was a failing college student with pride. Well, I can sort of draw a little bit, you know, I can kind of sort of draw a little bit. And so, you know, when someone can draw, they're like, oh, you got to go to college and get in the fine art department or something. And so I went to college and I was in fine art and we would draw bowls of fruit and sunsets and streams and stuff like that in a cabin out in the woods. And I was just like, you know, I just can't see myself doing that. I mean, I like to draw, but I just can't sort of picture myself this being my career. And so I was actually on the track team as well, and I'd hurt my leg. And so, in fact, we kind of joke about this. I met my friend Brett Lindsay. We were both naked in the hot tub because he had injured himself. He was a decathlete, and so we were both nursing these injuries in the hot tub, in the hot, and then we get in the ice, and then back on the hot. And so I asked him, we got talking, and we actually just met right then in the hot tub, and I asked him what his major was, and he said industrial design, and told me that it was basically you just design products. So these design toasters and cars, and there were no computers, but today you design new computer, you know, boxes and just everything, right? And I'm like, wow, that sounds really fun. He says, yeah, well, we design them and then we build them. And then we photograph them and stuff like that. So I thought, man, that's a lot better than drawing bowls of fruit for me. I mean, other people are really good at it and they can do it. But so I went to the department chair and I said, I'd like to switch majors. And so they accepted me into the industrial design department. But I had a teacher who didn't like to teach. He didn't like to be there. And so he would take and go on these quote unquote research projects, and you know, the university let him fly to somewhere and he would research, and then he would find somebody to take his place during the semester. Well, so this one semester we came back to class and we had a guy there, kind of a short little guy, and he said, hi, I'm taking the place of your teacher this semester, you're gonna have me. And we're like, yeah, figures, you know. John was his name. He said, John's gone, he's off somewhere, who knows where. And they had met, John, our teacher, had met this guy on a plane to Japan, and he talked him into taking the class, right? So he decided, actually he was Japan, he decided to stay in Japan, and this guy came to teach our class. And it turned out to be Douglas Trumbull. So anybody that knows special effects or whatever, he's like the dean of special effects. I mean, he, 2001, and, well, Blade Runner, and just, I can't even think of the ones that he's done, but you can Google him. So anyway, so Doug Trumbull comes and teaches our class. And he brings this thing called a script, which I'd never heard of, and he said, you just read it, and then we have to design everything that's in it. And the movie that he brought to us was Moby Dick in Outer Space. So you hunt the white whale in outer space, but not just outer space, you hunt the white whale in a black hole. So I'm going, wait a minute. I mean, I think it's a cool idea and everything, but you can't go into a black hole, right? Don't you get crushed? Don't black holes just crush entire planets? And that's when he talked me about the suspension of disbelief. You sort of just suspend your disbelief. And I'm like, look, I get it that a lightsaber isn't real, but it could work. You can kind of think that that's doable, but not going into a black hole. I could accept that the whales live in there because they could be some sort of species, but not humans go in there. And he's like, well, I don't know, dude, but you know, you're either going to fail or you're going to do the project. So I'm like, oh, man, I just switched majors and now I'm tanking again, you know. So I was walking home and there was a little pond on the way back to where I lived in this little house. And as I was walking by that pond, I was going, wait a minute. I was thinking, wait a minute, whales beach themselves in our world. Whales, sharks, porpoises, whatever, they beach themselves, right? What if in outer space a whale beached itself on the shores of a black hole. And then Ahab is out cruising around in his space sailing ship, and he sees this whale beached on the shores of this black hole. Goes down and gets it, takes it back to his place, and makes a spacesuit out of the body parts of a whale. You know, the eye would be the lens for the helmet, and the veins would be the tubes, air tubes, and you know, and the skin and the bones. So, because if a whale could survive in a black hole and you made a suit out of it, you could now survive in a black hole. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, now I can do it.
Now
right?
You're going.
Well, by this time, you know, everybody was well on their way to doing it and or doing all the projects and stuff, and I was well known as the, I don't know if it's the troublemaker, but some problem child. And so I was kind of over in the corner, nobody paying attention to me, but I began making this spacesuit out of the body parts of a whale. And I wish you could see pictures, and actually, if you go onto my IMDb, you can see pictures of it. But so I made this whole thing with I went and got like a motorcycle helmet, and I got a bubble shield to simulate the eye, you know, and then I made all the tubes and the veins and everything. And so, you know, this is what I did for the semester. And so at this time, you know, Doug would come and review us and stuff. And then sometimes he'd fly to L.A. and he'd have an assistant that would come and go. And so at the end of the semester, we did the review. And when we did the review, I really only had one sketch. But I had this entire suit that I had built. And when he saw it, he went over, looked at it, and right there in class said, "Do you want a job in Hollywood?"
Ooh.
And I was like, "Yeah, sure, I'd love to work in Hollywood. That's a great idea." And he's like, "No, I'm serious. I mean," he's like, "I'm flying out tonight, and I'd like to see you in my office like tomorrow or as soon as you can get there." And I'm like, "You mean like leave like now? Like go right like today or tomorrow?" And he's like, "Yep." So I was like, "Huh, okay, I guess, you know." He's like, "Yeah." And so he hired me right there. He flew back to L.A., and I drove down and began to work in his thing because he liked the design of it, because it was kind of like the biomechanical thing of today, sort of, you know. So it wasn't a ton of mechanical, but the bio thing of it with the body parts of this whale made it look pretty kind of cool. So we were going to shift over everything they had done to make that movie, all the stuff they'd done to make it match what I had done in class. So it was just, I mean, it was just a moment that you could not ever dream of it. You could never think of it. And it, you know, it just happened. I was like, wow. I mean, it just sort of fell right into that. So it was awesome.
That's awesome, yeah.
Yeah.
I love that story. And I actually, I know that you kind of gave it a different kind of ending, because it took a little longer than you were expecting.
Yeah. Well, actually, so he had an assistant. Her name was Liz Kern. She was his assistant. She went on to be a producer as well herself. But she would come, and she was from England, you know, and so she had this really cute accent, you know, and so we'd always try to get her to come over to our desk and talk to us and stuff so we could hear her talk and flirt with her and everything. And so we just loved her English accent. So what had happened when Doug said to come down to his studio, of course we have no GPS, we have no cell phones, you have no Skyping, you have no text, you have nothing. And so he wrote his number on a piece of paper. And he gave me the piece of paper and he said, "When you get into town, down in L.A., when you get into town, give me a call." So I'm like, okay, you know, that's kind of the way you did it. You know, you go out and play. You say, "Okay, Mom, I'll be back in a few hours." And you just go run around the neighborhood and you play. And when it gets dark, you come home. And so I just drove to California. He said, "Come down there." I drove to California. I've got this little piece of paper. And when I get down there, I find a payphone, put a quarter in it, and call up his studio. And so his secretary answers, you know, "Hello, Trumbull Studios." And I'm like, "Hey, yeah, Doug said he would give me a job, so I'm in town now, and so I'd like to come by and I'll start working, you know." And she's like, yeah, right, buddy. "You have an appointment?" And I'm like, "No, he just told me to call when I was, you know, whenever I got here and stuff." She's like, "Okay, well, you need an appointment." Click, and she hangs up the phone.
Oh.
And I was like, "Huh, all right, I'll go get something to eat and drive around, take a look at California." And I come back. So I had driven to, he actually was in Santa Monica. You know, you say go to Hollywood, but you know, their studios are really Century City and out and stuff. And his studio, they were down in Santa Monica, and so Venice area, you know. And so there was a Rouse grocery store, so I'm parked in the parking lot of Rouse grocery store, so I drive around, I come back to Rouse, and I go to the same payphone, and I call up, and I'm like, "Yeah, so is Doug back, or is he around?" I mean, you know, she's like, did you set an appointment? And I'm like, "No." And so she just hangs up the phone. Well, so I'm like, okay, whatever. And I don't have any money, so I can't really stay in a hotel because I'm still just a college student. I sort of gave all my junk away and sold stuff, but it was in the space of like a day. So I sleep in my car that night, and I wake up the next morning, and I go to the payphone, and I try to call, and have you got an appointment yet? And I'm like, no, how do you get an appointment? She's like, do you have an agent? And I'm like, I don't know what an agent is, you know, hang up the phone. So I do this day after day after day, sleep in my car, sponge bath in the Ralph's grocery store bathroom, buy food, bologna, peanut butter and jelly, whatever, and then sleep in my car and call and call and call and call and call. And finally, I have run out of what little money I have, and I'm thinking, if I don't leave pretty soon, I won't even have gas money to get home. Back to school, I'll go back as a failure, everyone will laugh at me, you know, oh, you're going to go to Hollywood, you know, you've got your butt kicked down. So I'm just sitting there, and I'm thinking, yeah, I got to go pretty soon, or I just won't even be able to make it. And I'm sitting there on the curb thinking about this whole thing and thinking about this experience. And as I was running it through my mind, kind of like the whale thing, you know, beaching of the whale, it dawned on me, oh, my gosh, Liz Kern was from England, right? The cute little accent and everything, right? So I think, that's it. That's the key. That's the answer. So I get up. I put a quarter in the phone. Right? I wait, it ring ring, she picks it up, hi, Trumbull Studios, and I went, oh, yeah, hello, I wonder if you can help me out, love. I need to talk to Douglas, and I've got some papers, I'm flying back to England soon, and I really got to talk to him, can you put me through? And she's like, yeah, sure, no problem, and she puts me right through to him. Right? Because everybody with an accent is, like, important or smart, or, you know, if you got an accent, you know, you can get everything you want, right? So she puts me right through, and he answers the phone, and he's like, hello, this is Doug. And I'm like, ah, Doug, hey. He's like, man, where you been? And I'm like, I've been here for like a week or 10 days, but I couldn't get through your front office. He's like, well, all right, well, come over to the studio. Where are you? And I'm like, I'm at the Rouse. You know, and he's like, wait, where? I'm like, I'm in the Rouse parking lot. And you know what he said to me? Turn around. I turn around. And the studio is literally no further from here to what we know at this con is the Applebee's right over here.
Oh, jeez.
I had been there. So I'm like Dorothy, right? I was home all along. I'd been home all along. I was there the whole time. I'm surprised I didn't see them coming and going every day to work, right? But it literally, I didn't even get in my car. I just hung up the phone and walked over there and started a 39-year career doing movies. So
how long were you in that parking lot? Like
I think it was about 10 days. I in my mind I'm kind of thinking it felt like 2 weeks, but I think it was, I know I'd gone through a weekend and I was coming up on another one, it felt like, and I know I had probably more than $5, but I remember thinking to myself, oh my gosh, I only have $5 left. Of course, gas, you know, back then you could buy a lot of gas for $5.
Yeah.
I'm sure I had more than that, but in my mind I can remember thinking, oh my gosh, I'm almost out of money, and so yeah, it was pretty interesting.
So you must have felt down in the pits to start out with, but then it turned out to be a great career, right?
Right, yeah. And that's the thing. It's something about humans, you know, if you really just, if you think about it, if something, I don't know, if, I don't want to say if you believe it'll work, because, I mean, I've believed in a lot of stuff that I've not gotten in my life. But there's something about us.
Like being persistent and...
Persistent and...
Setting goals and actually like...
Yeah.
Making sure that you reach your goal.
Right. Actually doing something. I think doing something is probably the most important thing. Just do something. And even sometimes that doing is thinking, you know, like the whale thing, or thinking and remembering. I don't know why Liz Kern popped into my mind, or who has the audacity to try to get into a motion picture studio posing as an Englishman, you know? I mean... It's ridiculous, but there's just something about that persistence and that indomitable spirit that humans have to, you know, it doesn't matter if you failed or if it doesn't look that good now, it can look that good next time, or, you know, if you make something or a costume even or whatever, it looks great now, and, you know, like Lynn Anderson here, his Iron Man last year I thought looked fantastic, but have you seen his new one? Oh my gosh, it's insane. So yeah, it's just something about if you stick with it. Here's a friend sitting in the audience here. You can't see, but I mean, he's now at LA Film School, and last year he was just talking about it, you know, and he just did it. And so, you know, he's coming up on finishing your first year, right? Finishing his first year, and so
that's awesome.
Yeah, super awesome. So persistence and yeah.
Well, even like in business, where you know you have action items. I'm going to do these things to get my goal towards this. And
And
have the goal. What am I doing to get the goal?
And there's some other thing though that and there's some other thing though that happens, and I relate it like this. I really believe this. And maybe it's I believe it if it's actually right for us or right for our life. But if you here's what's happened in my life. If you begin to build a bridge from your side of the river, so let's call this river the river of impossibility or the river of no. The whole world tells you no all the time. So here's this river that we always have. We have to cross this river all the time. And if you begin to build a bridge on your side, somehow the universe or whatever it is that you believe in, it begins to build this bridge from the other side. And I guess if it's right for you, when it's right, at some point you continue to build yours, the universe connects with you over the over this river of impossibility, and you can walk across that to your dream. I mean, that's happened over and over for me through my life. And so
for somebody who's wanting to get into this career, start building the bridge, what do you recommend?
Well, first off, like we say, do something. Do something that shows your talent, because it's still we're a visual species, and so you can say that I'm really talented. I can do anything. I can make anything. Just hire me. But if you actually had something, you don't have to talk. It's just doing all the talking for you. And that's whether you're writing something. If you're going to write a script, that script is talking for you. If you're making a prop or an outfit or a set or a steampunk gun, whatever it is, make that thing. Whatever you do, write that thing. Write that story, short story, one page, full feature. It doesn't matter. Do something that can do the talking for you, because that's what people are really looking to be convinced, right? And the way you convince them is by showing what you can do. That's why we make demo reels. That's why we have portfolios. That's why we have, you know, web pages that show what we do. So I think the main thing is do something so that you don't have to try and convince someone. What you did is going to do the convincing.
So I think last year I was able to kind of sit on your panel and just kind of listen to everything that you have actually done. But what I found interesting, especially with the shirt that you're wearing too today, that you had your DNA story helix model.
Right.
That you had for scripting.
Right.
And I wanted to see if you might be able to kind of tell us a little bit more about that.
Okay. I'll try. I mean, it's such a visual thing, like we're saying. It's kind of hard to do it. But I'll try to. It looks like the DNA helix. So that curved, that sort of, what is, you know, what the DNA, if you Google DNA, you know, that look thing.
Right.
Well, if you those that can see it on my shirt. But it's that DNA molecule thing. Well, when I started in, so basically what I didn't say when I did the Doug Trumbull thing is that when I realized or thought about the whale beaching itself on the shores of the black hole, well, that's not in the script. So I thought, okay, the only way I can make this work is to rewrite his script and add that in, not knowing, of course, you don't rewrite someone's story or someone's book, and you don't mess with what, you know, I don't know how much he paid for it, $500,000, I don't know, but you just don't go in and rewrite somebody's story. But I didn't know it. I'm just a dumb college kid. So I rewrote the story to add in this whole whale section that I needed to have in order to make this costume. And so I met a lady when I first went down to Hollywood to work in special effects, and she was a writer, and she wrote for CineFX magazine and everything. And she really liked that story that I had written in this thing and done it. And so we began to talk story, and I actually became more interested in story. And so then I met Joseph Stefano, who wrote the screenplay for Hitchcock, Psycho. And I started meeting other people, Joe Esterhaus and these guys at the time who were really hot writers and stuff. And I realized, wow, I love special effects, but I really love the story that gets created that then has a special effect in it. That right? So I'm making special effects, but someone has already, years ago maybe, written a story that includes and now or has this special effect that I'm making. So I started trading all kinds of, like back then when you get credits and things, I mean, they'd have to actually make it. Now they just type it into a computer, but you had to actually film the credits back then. So it cost money to put your name in. So I would trade away my, you know, it's like, you don't have to give me credit if you'll let me come to your writer's group or you let me hang out and listen to these writers. So I began to try and understand how they made a movie. How do you really write a good screenplay? And these guys were the masters at it. I mean, you know, Psycho and all these different movies and Basic Instinct was real, you know. And so I began to try and study under them, as it were. And they had a definite pattern in something, and I kept asking them if they would draw out how you do it. How do you draw the diagram of how you learn to ride a bicycle? Well, you just can't. You know, I mean, it's like, well, you know, if you start to fall, lean the other way. Well, that's easy to say, but go try to ride a bike when you don't know how. So I asked them to draw it, and they didn't know how to draw what their process was. And I couldn't understand their process till I drew it. Because I was artistic to some degree, I had to draw how a story flows, when the character comes in, what does the midpoint do, and why is it important, and how does a story turn, and when everyone says your character needs to have an arc, but what does that actually mean, and all that. So I began to, in my way, visually draw out this entire process of how at least a successful theatrical release movie worked. And when I finally drew out, okay, you got to have a character, and they do this, and then they go here, and then that, and then this story crosses with that story, like your subplot crosses with this or that. When I finally took all these things that I learned and sort of sketched it out, it looked like the DNA story or the DNA helix. And I was like, oh my gosh, could that really be possible? That the way a story functions, the subplots, the antagonist, the protagonist, you know, your hero, the bad guy, all the different supporting characters, is it really possible that that can have a form and look like something? And so that became the DNA story helix that I have.
So with that story helix, do you actually, because I have looked at your biography information and everything mm-hmm. online, but have you actually taught this to other students? And
yes,
Or at a university?
Right. I've actually taught at three universities, and I'm currently at Utah Valley University right now, and so I'm teaching a screenwriting class, how to write a screenplay now. So
that's really cool. So that's kind of part of your current work that you're doing at
uh-huh.
the moment.
So part of my current workload is that I go and play professor and try not to cuss too much in class and stuff like that. But so it's really exciting, and I've had tremendous students. And And this DNA story helix is very simple. I've always said it's hard to make something simple, but because I'm not very smart, I had to make it simple to understand it myself. And so it seems to ring pretty true. It seems to be fairly understandable, and the students have just turned out incredible work. One of my students won the 48-hour film festival regionally, I guess, here, and went on, and it got to they. Then took all the winners to France, and all of those films played in France, and then the top 10 of those films got to play at Cannes at the film festival, and they finished 12th in the world. Though they finished 12th in the world, so
that's amazing.
They did a really great job. So it's not all attributed to the story helix. I mean, they're great storytellers, but we've had some really good success down at the university so far, so we're really loving it. But
and I wouldn't say, like, you know, you weren't very smart. It's just everyone has their way of, you know, figuring out how to do things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And especially if you can work with people and go like, oh, this is how you end up doing things. Let me explain it that way. Because
yes.
I might not be able to understand it when you bring it back, but if I can explain it to you so you can bring it back to me so I can understand it now, we both work in our own ways.
Right, yeah. And you know, academia, they love to use big words for things, you know, and stuff. And I've never really learned those terms, and so my students will actually know some of those bigger words more than I will. But I know what people and producers and directors actually say. You know, they aren't usually university professors that are now directing movies, and so they don't use those terms, and they just deal with a more hands-on-ish kind of thing, and that's the background I come from, so I'm able to say it simply or more simply so that it's understandable. You know, there's so many kinds of characters, or there's that, and they, you know, academia can really dive deep, and a lot of times it's a very, very simple thing that really clicks in your brain, not a super, super complicated explanation.
Yeah.
So
are there any other projects that you're also presently working on at the moment?
Yeah,
that you can talk about.
We actually, people that I've met here at Snake River last year, Katrine, you mentioned her earlier, They have projects that we're working on, and I've connected. So she has scripts and different projects, which is why I was telling some people they need to connect with Katrine and her group, Madeline, her co-producer with her, is because they're doing films. They're shooting commercials every month and different short projects and a little bit larger projects. And then they have feature films that are in the works. And so I'm lining them up with some of the people that I know down in my area that actually fund projects, fund films. And so they're getting close to a really great film that talks about different challenges, characters that have physical challenges, you know. And so it's really cool for them to get closer and closer to their deal. So mainly I'm involved in helping some the people that I know put financing, put the right people, and connect it to the right, you know, the right project that they have. So, and then because I started in special effects, everyone's always asking me, they have some mechanical idea, you know, they have like, yeah, if you put this on a vacuum, it would just be the best in the world. And so I'm always kind of seemingly caught up in some kind of little widget or something. Somebody invents this little idea but can't really make it. And just from my experience of making different things move or characters move or a ghost fly or whatever it is, I'm able to help them to do that. I'm actually working on a dishwasher, a different kind of dishwasher of all things, but it's pretty exciting. You know, so I'll play professor, and then I'll help someone with their dishwasher, and then we kind of go from there. But
that's really cool. As far as like getting the connections and kind of everyone coming to the con and actually being able to actually meet people that have been able to succeed at what they have done, mm-hmm. and I think that it's a really good crossover, and just like being able to kind of teach and learn at the same time, because even I'm sure that you have learned quite a bit even when you have gone to several different cons and met several different people. So as far as like any additional projects, have you had any past projects or like anything currently that you may be able to share with us as far as what other connections that you've made as far as through the conventions?
Yeah, actually, this con, meeting Katrine, and she's actually in Boise, but they have quite a large group that they're connected with, and we've done a number of projects together in the last year that we've met, and so I don't know if I can say any of them because she's all still working on them, but I probably from Snake River have probably done more with the people I've met here than from any other con. I mean, I met Neil Kaplan, who's here. He's the voice of Optimus Prime and other people. I mean, he's really cool. He's in the back. Hopefully he can hear me. And oh, yeah, he's flipping me off. No, but anyway, so I met him at another con. And so I have met other people, and they've become friends, and we've stayed friends, and it's wonderful. But Snake River has probably produced more actual projects and works. I mean, I'm thinking of probably four scripts in the last year that aren't just ideas, that are scripts that we've met, we've hired directors, you know, we've engaged in funding, we've had the actors come out, and we've done the table, I mean, actually pursuing and going and doing. So script work that I think I've gotten more projects from Snake River in that realm than any other con I've ever done. And then just even today in that steampunk, how to turn a Nerf gun into a steampunk gun panel, I was on the panel, and the other two guys on the panel are just talking, and I'm just going, holy, I don't know any of this stuff. I'm sitting there with a gun I've made that I think looks pretty good, and I'm going, no, I didn't do that, and I should have done it. No, I didn't do that, and I should have done it. And they're talking about paint and, you know, clear coat this and just different process, and I'm like, wow, I don't think I have much to add to this because they were so good. And what was that one guy? Morgan, I think Morgan, he was really sharp, right? And I mean, even Nar Nygan down here, he knows a lot too. But yeah, so Snake River has turned a lot of movie work my way through the people I've met, and then taught me things about building stuff that, you know, I mean, I've been building stuff for 40 years, and I'm today learned a bunch of stuff just today. So
never stop growing.
Never stop growing. Yeah.
Is it because we're kind of a smaller growing con that you can connect with people a little better than like some of the bigger?
Yeah.
cons that are out there?
Yeah, yeah. I think you hit the nail on the head. Everyone's approachable here because, well, I mean, it's great to go to a con where there's 100,000 people, but it's hard to get that attention. And here, you can get that attention. You know, you can actually. It's just like everybody's just rubbing shoulders and talking, and you get that access. And when we're done, we'll probably all end up at the same restaurant somehow, or at least half of the people. And so then you can continue on talking, and because you're not being completely overwhelmed, there's plenty of time to talk, and people can come up, and you can spend quality time with them because it's not, you know, it's good size but not overwhelming, which is cool. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, we have to start wrapping up. So
no.
To finish up, how would people look you up or find you and look up all your information? Where should they go?
Probably IMDb, I guess. I think it's all on there. I'm trying to get more into social media. I'm on Facebook. My name is Randall, but it says Crit Randy Killen on Facebook. And then IMDb, I think, has my emails and stuff. So probably that. Probably Facebook and IMDb would probably be the best way.
Okay. So. Well, then, I'd like to thank you. And all thanks, right. Everyone else, for showing up.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thanks, guys.
Bye.
And away we go.